This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
We're going to start by talking about the revelation from special counsel John Durham this week that Hillary Clinton's campaign employed hackers and lawyers to spy on Donald Trump before he was elected president at Trump Tower and while he was president at the White House. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this revelation's been a long time in coming, but it was definitely worth the wait. This is no exaggeration to say that this is the biggest political scandal since Watergate, possibly the biggest political scandal in American history. Now, just to recap, John Durham is the in special counsel. He basically holds the same position in the government as Robert Mueller did when he was investigating the Russiagate hoax, although Durham is investigating the investigators and uncovering a ton of corruption behind that fake Russiagate scandal. Michael Sussman is a campaign lawyer for Hillary Clinton who was indicted by a grand jury last September on charges of lying to a Federal Bureau of Investigations agent. And now, just last Friday, John Durham filed another motion, really getting into the details of the lies he told. Now, when Sussman was talking to this FBI agent back before Trump was inaugurated, but after he was elected, he told the FBI agent that he had evidence that Trump had a Russian bank account, or the Trump organization had a Russian bank account. Nothing inherently wrong with that, but given all the other fake news about Trump-Russia collusion at the time, it looked suspicious. So obviously the FBI, their first question was like, well, how do you know that? And he's like, well, he's like, are you working for someone? And he told him he was just a concerned citizen. Now, according to this new indictment from last Friday, he was not just a concerned citizen, but was actually working for the Clinton campaign and working with a tech executive and a tech company to spy on both Trump Tower and even on the White House after Trump was inaugurated. The indictment shows that he repeatedly received regular payments from the Clinton campaign. So the Clinton campaign was paying Michael Sussman to spy on Trump Tower and on the White House. The indictment also shows that the tech executive, they just call him Tech Executive One in the indictment, but they've numerous news reports have very easily found out that that was actually Rodney Joff, who worked for the company Neustar. And so they do business with the government, so they had some access to their servers and even access to internet networks nationwide. So it was not necessarily difficult for them to infiltrate the servers at both Trump Tower and then later on in the White House to get this information about what bank accounts does Trump has and other classified information, which is a federal crime to just spy on someone like Trump Tower without a warrant. And then as Trump himself spying on Trump Tower was bad enough. You're spying on someone who was elected the president. That's a gross violation of privacy rights and should be punishable by imprisonment. But spying on the White House after Trump was inaugurated is an order of magnitude bigger crime than that. Now you're not just spying on a private citizen who happened to have been elected president, but you're actually spying on the U.S. government itself. Donald Trump issued a written statement about this indictment, just kind of giving his opinions, where he said it was a bigger scandal than Watergate, which is definitely true. And he also said that in a stronger time in American history, this would be punishable by death, which actually is also true. I mean, probably the spying on Trump Tower, you could have gotten away with imprisoning it. But like I said, spying on the government, I mean, that is high treason. And like I said, a good lawyer could make the case for the death penalty for something that serious.
For such a massive scandal, it's remarkable how Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily radio show, how uninterested in this story the press was for days. And then when they started to cover it, the mainstream press, they dismissed it entirely and said that this was just basically fabricated, concocted, that it was convoluted, it was gobbledygook, and totally not worth the time devoted to it. This was like a trumped up story by Fox News and the right.
Right. No, that is shocking. I mean, and it does just go a long way to showing you how much the corporate news media in America is owned by people with deep connections into the government, that they'd cover something like this up. Because John Durham, I mean, he is a special counsel, which is the exact same position Robert Mueller held. I mentioned that earlier. And when Robert Mueller was investigating like the Trump-Russia collusion, it's like all you heard about for three or four months.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'd even heard from some people from like other countries that they like listening to American news, that they almost could be forgiven for having the impression that Robert Mueller was the most powerful man in America and that he could fire the president whenever he wanted to. And of course, none of that was true. But I mean, that was definitely all you heard about for months, is how much that he's going to find these Trump-Russia collusion ties. And then, of course, he got to the end of his investigation and kind of had to give a press conference with his tail between his legs, admitting he didn't find anything. And now even the liberal news media, like the New York Times, is admitting that there was nothing to the Russiagate scandal. And so they've been forced to admit that the Russia collusion narrative never happened. And so now you have John Durham coming in and figures like, well, why was it such a big thing if there was no evidence? That's a perfectly reasonable question. It's like, well, and so he's looking into things like the Steele dossier and these spying allegations, and actually finding out that Christopher Steele, he was the main source for the dossier that Trump was colluding with the Russians, that like he actually didn't even have that many contacts with the Russian government, but was mainly talking to a Russian lawyer who was talking to a lawyer in the Clinton campaign. And so the Clinton campaign was just making stuff up, telling this Russian guy to it, who then told it back to them to make it look like it was coming from a foreign nation when they invented it themselves. Mm-hmm. And then in order to actually get like more evidence to bolster up their fake claim, they hacked into Trump Tower and the White House and found out that Trump had a bank account in Russia, which is not illegal. Many businessmen do. But it looks suspicious coming right after all these fake claims about Trump-Russia collusion. So there is a big story here. It's like this was a huge media thing for months when there was no evidence. So it's like, how was there no evidence? It's like, well, that's what John Durham's trying to find out. And the media dismissing it, especially when they made such a big deal about it the first time around, is really hypocritical. But more than that, shows just how much that they don't want the public to find out their complicity in the first fake story.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen Fleury has been covering this beautifully on the Trumpet Daily radio show. I would certainly encourage you to go listen to his coverage of this. He also wrote an article this week. It was up on Tuesday. Obama and Clinton spied on President Trump. There was also an article by Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, on this on Monday. So we expect more coverage to come on this, and also more legal action from John Durham in the time ahead. I'm sure that this is really just, again, in the early stages. Like John Ratcliffe said, that there are a whole lot of people who are in criminal jeopardy based on the evidence that he has seen. So I imagine that there are far greater fireworks to come. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Andrew. Is the Ukraine crisis over? Vladimir Putin says he is withdrawing his troops. evidence shows otherwise. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Tuesday that the Russian government announced that it was starting to withdraw some Russian troops from the borders of Ukraine and beginning to return those troops to their bases. A spokesman for the Russian Military of Defense said that day that some Russian troops had, quote, already begun loading onto rail and road transport and will begin moving to their military garrisons today. So, you know, global markets rallied at those statements. Many onlookers breathed a real sigh of relief because there were hopes that military tensions were finally beginning to ease after months of intensifying. But then yesterday, new intelligence from the United States, which was backed up by commercial satellite photos, said that Russia has actually added more troops to its forces around Ukraine, about 7,000 more. So they did have an estimated 140,000, a little over that, at the beginning of the week. But now, despite Russia's claims of a drawdown, that number is believed to be closer to 150,000. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about this yesterday. He said, "We have not seen a pullback. Vladimir Putin can pull the trigger. He can pull it today. He can pull it tomorrow. He can pull it next week. The forces are there if he wants to renew aggression against Ukraine." And then State Department spokesman Ned Price echoed those same sentiments. And he said the U.S. had seen, quote, more Russian forces, not fewer. So, you know, this should come as no surprise, really. The Russian playbook is to paint one picture publicly, but then do exactly the opposite. But whatever Russia's long-term plan is here, this threat is apparently still far from over.
It's almost comical the way that to accept Russia's story, Russia's view of these events, the way that they've unfolded. This is the ultimatum that they issued against NATO in December, basically saying, we want to undermine the very substance of the existence of this alliance, and issued all of these demands. You either do this or, you know, there are going to be consequences. And shortly after that, you see this massive influx of Russian troops all around Ukraine, completely surrounding it. And it's military drills with Belarus and some of these other surrounding nations that the Russians, the whole time, they're just saying there's no explicitly stated link between the demands for NATO and what they're doing around Ukraine. But all of the Western nations, the United States, European nations are all saying, like, invasion is imminent. Russia never said that explicitly. Now they're just saying, well, now we're going home, and I don't know what you all were so worked up about to begin with.
Yeah, it's true. And as I said, a lot of this is straight out of the Russian playbook. There's always a lot of manipulation and just mendacity of all shades. And they're gaslighting us to a degree. They decry U.S. Spokespeople whenever they say, oh, it looks like an invasion is imminent. They say, why would you think that? We only have 140,000 troops and all these, you know, incredibly advanced missile defense systems around the country. It's really bizarre.
Nothing to be concerned about.
Right, exactly. But it is Russia. But at the same time, as all of these Russian troops are continuing their buildup, despite claims to the contrary, we're also seeing an increase in false claims from Russia, which Putin could actually use as a pretext for invasion. So it's pretty interesting, but the Russians are fabricating stories saying that the U.S. and Ukraine are now developing biological weapons together. We're also seeing some fabricated stories about mass unmarked graves of Russian civilians allegedly killed by Ukrainian forces. So basically that's an accusation against Ukraine of committing genocide against the ethnic Russians that live in the east of the country. There are reports that the West is sneaking guerrilla soldiers into Ukraine to work against Russian interests. So all kinds of stories like this. And of course, these are false, but they are alarming. And they are the kind of thing that Putin could point to and say, well, you know, I didn't necessarily want to invade, but look at what the U.S. is doing. Look at what Ukraine is doing. So now we really have to invade. And then beyond just the false reports, there has been an increase in the fighting in eastern Ukraine over the last couple of days. Ukrainian forces and Russia-led forces have been, you know, locked in a low-level conflict there ever since Putin first invaded Ukraine back in 2014. But now that violence is heating up. Once again, there was even a kindergarten in eastern Ukraine yesterday that was shelled by Russian-led forces. Some unconfirmed reports say that some children were injured in that attack. But whether or not children were injured, that's just a major provocation to go after that kind of a target. And there's some speculation that going after such a vulnerable civilian target was designed to provoke a big response from Ukraine so that, you know, it would then justify a full-scale invasion from Russia. So a lot of question marks. It's hard to see exactly what the calculus is behind some of this, but the tensions are rising quickly, and it is easy to see how this could lead to a real explosion of violence.
What Russia is doing here, we look at this through the lens of biblical prophecy, and particularly the relationship between Europe and Russia, which we've talked about quite a lot lately. Europeans truly do fear what Russia is capable of doing in Ukraine. And maybe you could just explain why that's significant prophetically.
Yeah, sure. You're exactly right. Many eyes right now, especially in Eastern Europe, are just locked on Russia's buildup. And a lot of European voices are just speaking up about how fearful they are of Russia's aggression. So this does show the effect that all of this is having in Europe. Just a great number of Europeans see what Russia's already done in Georgia and in Ukraine. They think that their country could be next, especially Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, some of those smaller nations. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has warned for years about how this European fear of Russia will be a major factor that causes Europeans to unite their countries into a massive political and military bloc. So it was just after Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine back in 2014 that he wrote about this. He wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of a European empire." So, you know, the Europeans are fearful, and it's easy to see why. They see this massive troop buildup. They're deeply worried. And a lot of them believe that the best way to stand up to the threat is to unify European nations together. So this will, just as Mr. Flurry wrote there, this will play a pivotal role in the unification of Europe that we've been expecting.
Well, we will link to that article, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe," in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We've been tracking Iran's nuclear activities as nuclear negotiations continue. The story this week gives further cause for concern. For this story, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there's a story in the Jerusalem Post this week, and it's entitled, "Why is no one talking about Iran digging a new unbombable nuclear facility?" And this is a really interesting piece because, of course, Israel has really been clandestinely attacking Iran's nuclear facilities for the last few years in several locations, above ground facilities. And Iran is actively seeking a way to ensure that it can create nuclear fuel and create nuclear weapons and then be able to store them and them to be untouchable by airstrikes. And so it does have an underground facility already at Fordo. That one, Israeli analysts have asked the question for the past decade whether Israel has the weaponry to make sure that it can penetrate the mountain that it's under to try and destroy that if needs be. And that has been a very big concern for Israel. But now Iran is actually constructing a far deeper underground facility underneath a mountain. This mountain is called Ku-i-Kolan-Gazla, and it's in the Natanz region. Israel has struck nuclear facilities in the Natanz region both in July 2020 and in April 2021. Clandestine attacks, explosions, perhaps from the inside, and then Israel doesn't really publish details about these, but it set Iran's nuclear program back a little bit, they say. Now Iran is looking to go underneath this mountain. Construction has already begun. This facility won't necessarily be completed until perhaps the early part of 2023. But this is a mountain that's 1,600 meters above sea level, and it's about twice as big as the Fordow mountain that the underground facility is under. And so if Israelis were wondering if they could hit that one, this one's going to be twice as hard to get at. Now, this is obviously, it begs lots of, people need to ask lots of questions about this. The biggest question people should ask, if they still believe Iran is dedicated to just peaceful nuclear and becoming a peaceful nuclear power and enriching to 3 or 5%, that's all it's needed to for a peaceful program, then why are they making such an effort to dig underneath this massive mountain for its advanced centrifuges? That's question number one. And I think question number two should be, while the world is stuck in this period of appeasement, is the world giving Iran so much of a leash that it is, even if there are leaders that come in the future that would like it to attack Iran, that don't believe in this policy of appeasement, will it be too late to stop Iran and their nuclear program if this facility is up working?
Yeah, those are two very good questions. I think the question in the Jerusalem Post article headline is also a good question. Why is no one talking about the fact that Iran is doing this? This report speaks of the Institute for Science and International Security President David Albright writing about this and talking about this, but you're not hearing about this among the nations that are in the nuclear negotiations. And I guess it speaks to your second point about just how committed to appeasing Iran these nations are.
Right. You've got a dedicated effort right now to in these negotiations, which France is saying that Iran's got a couple of days or else they're going to walk away, meaning that they need to agree to something very fast. But you've got people negotiating with Iran when it becomes increasingly obvious what Iran is wanting, that it is more than just peaceful nuclear power. And if this story about this major construction process underground, under this mountain, is something that's well known and it's in Western media, surely that is something that does prove, again, Iran's desire to have weapons, nuclear weapons. And I think that's probably one of the reasons nobody's talking about it. Also, nobody's really talking about it because it means if you talk about this, you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to act on it. And which nation is willing to act on it? I mean, Israel right now, this government, Israel says that it has the prerogative, if it likes, to attack at any time Iran's nuclear facilities. But the United States, the biggest restraint on Israeli action right now against Iran are the Americans. And they've basically put a leash on Israel and says, you can't do that. Don't do that. Our relationship is on the line if you go ahead and do that, because this is their goal. Their goal is to have a nuclear deal with Iran. And really, as we talked about on Wednesday's program, for Iran to actually get the bomb. And so if Israel isn't going to be willing to act on this nuclear facility, who will? And I think that the biggest danger here is we are getting to the point where Iran's nuclear program is out of anyone's control. And perhaps that has been part of the process for these nuclear negotiations and the delays and the delays and the delays, is for Iran's nuclear program to no longer be accessible to airstrikes so that no one else can take it out. We are seeing right now Iran being given the protection or giving their nuclear program a protection that anything but ground invasion into Iran's nuclear facilities in some way would stop them achieving a nuclear weapon, becoming a nuclear power.
Well, we spoke about the prophetic significance of this development in Iran on our program on Wednesday. You can go listen to that segment from Brent on Trumpet Hour from Wednesday this week. And if you want to really get a full prophetic picture, you can read Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South. We'll link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Amid quite a lot of bad news in recent years. Britain's royal family had another terrible week. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, the royal family has been caught up in two major scandals this week involving the Queen's two sons. The biggest, the most notable, was Prince Andrew. He settled out of court this lawsuit where he has been accused of sexual assault in conjunction or in association with Jeffrey Epstein. He reportedly paid about $12 million, or I think it was £12 million actually, to his accuser. He had to sell off one of his ski chalets in order to do so. And this whole scandal is something that's got the potential for a lot of long-range ramifications. In some ways, I think some people are breathing a sigh of relief within the royal family. You know, this is the Queen's Platinum Jubilee year. There's lots and lots of celebrations planned. At least that year won't be overshadowed with the kind of drip of shocking revelations coming out from an ongoing U.S. court case and depositions and all of these different types of events constantly keeping the story in the news stream. But in the longer term, I think this is incredibly damaging for the royal family. I mean, the perception is Prince Andrew, he's always claimed that he's never met this accuser, you know, that it's completely that these accusations are completely ridiculous. I think people have a hard time believing that you would pay £12 million to silence an accuser that you had never met. It certainly makes it certainly raises a lot of questions about how truthful he has been. I mean, there was no admission of guilt in this settlement. But again, you know, paying 12 million people, do you do that when you're innocent? I mean, maybe he didn't want to get dragged through the courts, but it's not a good look for the royal family. And now there are all kinds of questions about what did the Queen have to step in and help cover this bill? Why was even Prince Andrew involved with Jeffrey Epstein at all? These kind of questions. And so the dust was just settling on that when we were hit by another scandal where the police announced they were investigating a scandal that was in connection with Prince Charles. One of Prince Charles's closest aides, his right-hand man, really, Michael Fawcett, he apparently traveled around the world, or he's accused of traveling around the world, promising people knighthoods in exchange for donations to Prince Charles's charitable foundation. So it sounds very Clinton-esque, exactly the same thing the Clintons are kind of accused of doing. In particular, he is alleged to have talked to a Saudi billionaire, said that, oh, yep, we'll give you like a higher form of knighthood in exchange for a generous donation to Prince Charles's charitable foundation. And Prince Charles claims that he knew nothing about this, that his right-hand man was just kind of doing this on his own accord. But again, a lot of people have trouble believing that. So the police, these accusations have been going on for a while, but this week the police announced that they were getting involved. They were following up on some of these accusations. So Prince Andrew's police investigation has just stopped, or court case has just stopped, but the police investigation to Prince Charles may only just be getting started.
Put this in context for us, Richard. This has been, as I mentioned, years of problems for the British royal family. The family has changed substantially from having had considerable popularity in Britain recent years. Several things have completely tarnished the royal family's reputation and also its role within Britain. And there are reasons for that from the Trumpet's perspective.
That's right. I mean, it really feels like each year is worse than the last, that we kind of come out of one year saying, well, that was a terrible year for the royal family, only to have worse things happen with Prince Andrew and then Prince Harry. We've basically had two senior members kicked out of the royal family. Just one would be unprecedented. But if you go back to 2017, we had a cover article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry talking about the royal family. There was the Queen on the front cover there. And in that article, he said that it will get... He talked about how this has been a terrible year for the royal family. And then he said, it will get much worse. A forecast that we have seen fulfilled exactly. He talked about the declining morals. He said Britain no longer has such respect for the Bible or for God. He said Britain has lost its faith in God and King and its moral moorings at the same time. One thing that I think is interesting is he spent a lot of that article focusing on family values and the decline of the family values in the royal family, how that was leading the entire nation in the decline of family values, how vital that was for both the royal family and Britain. And then so many of these scandals that we've seen that have come out after that have all been related to family values, even to the point that in the Daily Mail, a columnist this week, just I think today, was right, called the royal family quite possibly the most dysfunctional family on the planet. Certainly not setting a good example in those family values. And Mr. Flurry wrote in that article, family is the most sacred of all institutions. Strong families are the backbone of a nation. When families fall apart, nations fall apart. And so because of all of these problems, in part and because of some of these issues, Mr. Flurry wrote, God is already changing the way he deals with the royal family, which explains why 2017 has been so tragic so far. And it was based on this critical change that Mr. Flurry made his forecast about things getting much worse, something that we have seen brought out by subsequent events. And so, you know, he made these statements because the royal family has historically played a major role. Britain and America, as we talk about in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, they're descendant from the ancient nations of Israel. God promised King David he would always have his family there ruling over part of these tribes of Israel as a light. And God is having to make a major change now in how he deals with that promise. And that promise gives what happens to the royal family a global significance. So Mr. Flurry introduced that subject with the fall of the British royal family from the September 2017 Trumpet print edition. That's a great place to go to learn more about it.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll link to that in the show notes. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, the death of freedom in Canada. Hezbollah in Lebanon succumbing to popular pressure and distancing itself from Iran, Europe's activities in Africa, and a warning that America needs to get tough fighting Chinese cyber espionage. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Up now to Canada, where the trucker protest against COVID mandates has provoked the Prime Minister to crack down with stunningly authoritarian measures. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, almost 10 years ago, Justin Trudeau gave a fundraiser to a group of politicians, where he said that the country he admired most, aside from Canada, was communist China because of their ability to use centralized government to get things done without debate. And probably more people should have paid attention to that speech, because this week he's done one of the most dictatorial things in Canadian history. He's actually invoked the Emergency Powers Act to shut down the truckers' protests. Now, the Emergency Powers Act, it replaces the War Powers Act. It was enacted in 1988, and it's never been used before because it's supposed to be a way for the leader of Canada to basically use martial law-style powers to protect his country from an insurrection or foreign invasion so deadly that it actually threatens the existence of the Canadian Republic. And so by invoking this against the truckers, Trudeau's basically telegraphed to the nation that he considers this trucker protest as an existential threat to the Canadian Republic, and is now able to use government power to haul away the trucks, forcibly disperse the protest, even freeze the accounts, bank accounts of those participating in this protest so they do not have the funds to continue. Now, he's had a little bit of trouble still yet. I think he ordered one of the trucker companies, one tow truck company, to start towing semi trucks away from an area, and the tow truck company told them that they had COVID and couldn't do it. Although I think he has started freezing bank accounts. Like GoFundMe is already frozen a lot of the money that Canadians have been donating to these trucker protests, and so a lot of the truckers were switching over to like a Give and Go, which is kind of like an evangelical Christian alternative to GoFundMe. So I think that's one of the reasons he's had to use this Emergency Powers Act, because with GoFundMe it was so liberal that he could just ask and they did it. Where with some of these other internet funding campaigns that are more conservative, he actually needs government power to like cut off these people's funds. But I mean, just really shocking, like I said, this has never been done before in Canadian history. So the fact that they're doing this now, I mean, really just highlights how dictatorial the Trudeau administration has become. He said, if you would have done this back in the summer of 2020, people may have actually gone along with it because COVID hysteria was at its peak. But instead, back in the summer of 2020, he was actually praising the truckers as being like brave fighters who are risking getting COVID to make sure grocery store shelves are stocked. Now, oddly enough, that COVID's almost over, they've made these vaccine mandates that you can't cross the border unless you're vaccinated. The truckers had enough of it, so they're closing down the Ambassador Bridge into Michigan and protesting in Ottawa and doing other things to just really try to get the government to back down on these mandates. And the government, so far, they're not backing down. They're using martial law to try to haul away trucks, freeze bank accounts, and this tension just keeps ratcheting up and up and up and up and up and up. And I guess it's still too early to tell whether the truckers are going to back down or whether Trudeau's going to back down. But whoever backed down is going to lose a lot of face now. There's really no way that once the prime minister declares martial law and the truckers still continue their protest, I mean, you've got a lot of people have got like a lot of reputation, a lot of ego at stake here. Whoever backs down is going to be a humiliating defeat for either the side of freedom or the side of communism.
We have an article by Abraham Blondeau on thetrumpet.com. Trudeau adopts wartime powers to stop freedom protests. We'll link to that in the show notes. But he lists a whole slew of measures that the government is taking here. And you wonder, if it were not for, do you have any sense of the legal defensibility of what the government of Canada is doing here, absent the Wartime Act? Like for them to deny Canadians this many rights. If somebody says, you know, I like what the truckers are doing, I'm going to donate some money to them to make sure that they're able to have food and they're taken care of while they're speaking out against the government measures like this, the government says you can no longer use your bank account. That's a pretty extremely invasive overreach by the government into private citizens' lives based on political views and supporting something that is, you know, on its face, an understandable protest. Are there people speaking out about just how this would be illegal under any normal circumstances? Or is this just a blanket, you know, naked exposure of how much Justin Trudeau dislikes Canadian citizens?
No, it's the blanket naked exposure, because like I said, Canada is a constitutional republic like the United States. I'm not as familiar with their constitution as I am with the U.S. Constitution, but they have freedom of speech and they have freedom of assembly and things like that. So like you can't force a trucker to drive if he doesn't want to drive, and you can't tell a trucker he can't peacefully demonstrate if he wants to peacefully demonstrate. And you certainly can't take money away from private Canadian citizens who want to support a demonstration. So, I mean, all of this is completely illegal. Like I said, apart from the War Powers Act, and even the War Powers Act is probably illegal in the in the fact that, like I said, this is supposed to be for like an insurrection against Canada's democratic form of government, when instead, like, this isn't an insurrection. This is a peaceful demonstration according to Canadian law. So, I mean, this is definitely Trudeau just trying to force his will against Canadians' legal rights. And it's not just it's like conservative talk shows that are speaking out against it. I mean, they've had some pretty heated debates on the floor of the Canadian Parliament himself, with people calling Trudeau a dictator for this. They had one pretty high profile one this week where one conservative MP had called Trudeau out for being a dictator, and he leveled back with like, well, you're standing with you call me a dictator, but you're standing with people who are waving swastikas, and I don't know if there was actually any swastikas at this report. Maybe there was one of like some sort of infiltrator, but he leveled this accusation in Parliament, and then like the Conservatives came back with a pretty good reply, saying this, like, some of them, there are actually some Canadian MPs who are the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, and so that's extremely insensitive of Trudeau to right. make that comparison. So now they're calling him a dictator and demanding that he apologize for accusing those who are standing up for free speech of being Nazis. And so
it is surreal hearing him describe and hearing the press describe this as a bunch of right-wing extremists. There's violence, there's hate speech, there's this and that, and you see the pictures and you see the video, and it's, you know, people playing hockey in the streets, and you know, the worst fight that you see is a couple of Canadians with snow shovels, shoveling snow in each other's faces in a good-natured way, and then having a hug afterwards. You know, for them to brand all of this as the most extreme activity of the far right, and Stephen Fleury was bringing out yesterday the way that they're even redefining freedom, that they're looking at the word freedom as this rallying cry of extremists and this type of thing. The Nazis are all for freedom now. It's really quite remarkable the way that they're able to do this. Again, Stephen Fleury has been covering this quite well on the Trumpet Daily this last week. Listen to what he has been saying, and we also have that article by Abraham Blondeau, Trudeau adopts wartime powers to stop freedom protests. We thank you for that, Andrew. Over now to Lebanon. We've talked for years about biblical prophecies showing this Middle Eastern nation would turn away from Iran and toward Europe. Evidence of this is unfolding this week. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, these are two stories that might not seem to have too much significance, but they really do highlight this trend, as you brought out, that we, in terms of biblical prophecy, fully expect Iran's sway over Lebanon, which it holds right now through its proxy Hezbollah, for that to diminish in a very amazing, dramatic way, and in turn for Europe to enter, becoming the dominant outside factor inside Lebanon. And two stories. One of them is that Hassan Nasrallah came out this week, and he had an interview, I think it was actually middle of last week. And the interview was with the Iran-based Arabic news channel Al Alam. And it was interesting because it talked about how that in an event of an Israeli strike on Iran's nuclear facilities, that Hezbollah itself would not have to be part of the response against Israel. And this is something that's very surprising. A number of people noted, the Jerusalem Post and others, that this was an attempt by Nasrallah to somewhat distance himself from Iran, probably for the domestic view, for the domestic and politics, because right now Hezbollah is under increasing pressure from the Lebanese, because the Lebanese blame Hezbollah, lots of them, for their horrific economic situation, the worst situation it's seen, I think, in about 40 years. And so the reason for that, Lebanese recognize, is Iran's power over Hezbollah. If Hezbollah was just going to be a Shiite organization that cared about Lebanese politics and wasn't answering the Lebanese people and wasn't answering to Iran, I think the Lebanese would accept them 100%. However, because of this increasing pressure Hezbollah is under from the population, here is one instance where he's saying, well, there is a bit of separation. We aren't just the lapdog of the Iranians. We have the ability to make our own decisions when in terms of firing on Israel, something that would threaten the lives of more than just Hezbollah in terms of Israeli response onto Lebanese citizens.
So Hezbollah putting some distance between it and Iran. The second story closely related to this in a way.
Yeah, it's the story about the port area and who's going to be able to have a lot of the control. Remember this port, the Beirut port, was blown up on August 4th, 2020, and this was one of the most massive explosions, non-nuclear explosions, that the world's ever witnessed, and it really devastated the port, the downtown area of Beirut as well. 216 people at least were killed. But just this week, the French, I think it was today, actually, just yesterday, the third largest container shipping company in the world, CMA CGM Group, they were awarded the contract for the next 10 years to develop the container port and to make sure that not just develop, but also run the shipping containers through the Beirut port. And this is a French company. With long history in Lebanon, it actually runs the Tripoli port as well. I think Lebanon's second biggest port from memory. And so now they're going to be setting up camp as well, right in Beirut and that important port facility. Now, why that port facility was blown up the first time, people remember, it was because there was massive amounts of nitrate, ammonium nitrate, that was stored there that caused this huge explosion. I think only about 15 to 20% of the ammonium nitrate that was said to have been there was actually causing that explosion. I think the FBI came out and said that. And everyone in Lebanon knows who's responsible. It was Hezbollah keeping the ammonium nitrate there so they could use it for other bombs throughout the world. And we've been able to trace ammonium nitrate, Hezbollah cells using it in several countries in Europe, Far East Asia as well, Cyprus. And so we know that they were using it. And what's interesting now in the aftermath, and this is something we talked about, in the aftermath of this explosion, we would see more and more European intervention into Lebanon. It's perhaps been slower than we anticipated. Mm-hmm. But using this historic ties with the French, I think that having a French company become more involved in the shipping in Beirut, it's definitely a worthy trend for us to watch, and we expect more and more French and European influence inside Lebanon to continue.
Well, give us that overview of the prophecy that we've been tracking on Lebanon's future.
Yeah, this was brought out in our article, The Beirut Blast, Catalyst for Biblical Prophecy. This is from that, just in the aftermath of that explosion. And we talk about how biblical prophecy, in terms of Middle Eastern alliances, details two major alliances, one called the King of the South, which is a radical Islamic kingdom led by Iran, and the other, this alliance that of moderate Arab states that combines with European powers, that's found in Psalm 83. And Lebanon is mentioned by its ancient names inside not the Iranian-led alliance, but actually the alliance in Psalm 83. And so we are expecting and have expected, based on that, a massive flip in Lebanese and the power over Lebanon. Right now, Hezbollah still is the most powerful force in Lebanon. But as Europeans move in, as public discontent with Hezbollah's hold over Lebanon increases, we're watching for this big shift to take place. I think if people want to understand more about how the Beirut blast, and this is a response, what we're seeing right now is a response to that, will affect biblical prophecy, they should read that article, The Beirut Blast, Catalyst for Biblical Prophecy.
All right, very good. We will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Several stories this week on Europe's activities in Africa. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Over 40 African leaders traveled to Brussels this week for a major European meeting with the European Union. And the EU talked about how they wanted to reset their relationship with Africa. And after the events of the last week, you can certainly see why they need to be reset. I think the most notable was that France is pulling their military out of Mali. They've been there for 9 years to try and fight terrorism. They're having a hard time getting along with the new kind of military dictatorship that came to power in a coup. They're having a hard time getting along as well with the Russian militia mercenaries from the Wagner Group, I think they pronounce it differently from the German Wagner, that have been coming from Russia. So they've pulled out after the difficulties there. And Mali isn't the only country where they've been having trouble. All across Africa, there have been quite a series of coups, and this has presented some big difficulties for African, for European countries getting involved in the area. At the same time this week, we've had Europe's Frontex border agency. In some ways, this is the closest thing that the EU has to an army right now, with armed personnel serving under an EU flag. And one of the things that was in discussion with these meetings with African leaders was about technical discussions about deploying Frontex abroad, having these armed forces serve in North Africa, which, again, would be a significant step towards Frontex being a fully fledged type of or a more military type of unit, and also a big step in increased involvement in Africa. And EU officials also talked with African leaders about ways to scale up military operations in the country. So this talk of a reset seems exactly accurate. The EU has been driven to be more involved in North Africa because of these pressures from terrorism and migrants, but the way that they have been doing it right now hasn't been working. So they need to find a different way to get involved. Maybe we'll see Germany take the lead rather than France in some of that involvement. But watch this story. It is very important. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has an article titled Watch Algeria. He talks about that you've got a biblically prophesied clash, a clash prophesied in Daniel chapter 11 that takes place across all of this area. Watch for Europe to get involved in that. Since that article came out, I think in 2014, we've had more and more involvement, but it looks like we could be set for a new chapter of European involvement in North Africa, where they try to get involved in a different, maybe even a more direct way. So keep watching this space.
Marvelous. Well done, Richard. Watch Algeria is the article you can look at for more information about this. Finally, a warning that America needs to get tough fighting Chinese cyber espionage. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was just yesterday that the U.S. government's main China panel heard testimony from Harvard's Belfour Center for Science and International Affairs. And their testimony was all about China's cyber espionage and cyber warfare against America. So it emphasized the persistence of the Chinese attacks and China's ability to exploit the U.S.'s free market system. It also went into quite a bit of detail about the painfully slow pace of any kind of American response to these attacks. So the Belfour Center is sounding the alarm on, you know, just how vulnerable U.S. systems are to hacks. And they're saying that America needs to begin to take this far more seriously. So far, the measures the U.S. has taken include creating a list of Chinese companies with military connections and, you know, putting sanctions on them. But the Belfour Center says this has been utterly inadequate, and that America needs to start to view Chinese hacking the way we saw the space race with the Soviet Union. So that means, you know, just extreme vigilance and focus and marshaling whatever resources are necessary to keep from being outmaneuvered. The panel's testimony also said that if the U.S. is to get serious about combating Chinese hacking, it has to require companies like Microsoft and Google to become pillars in this fight. So it is a major threat, but the truth is that this threat has been well identified for more than two decades, and the U.S. has done little to stand up against it. So, I mean, as refreshing as it is to hear a panel issuing this kind of testimony and warning, I think there's very little reason to expect America to make the changes needed to reduce its dependency on cyber systems and to really stand up to these attacks.
From a prophetic perspective, why is this significant? Where would you send people for information?
Yeah, America's cyber vulnerability, it's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has been warning about for more than 20 years now. He first cautioned about it back in 1995, warning that America and specifically the American military had become just dangerously dependent on computer systems that are vulnerable to enemy sabotage. In an article at that time, he wrote, "America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, but we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It's so dangerous that I'm amazed it hasn't received more publicity." And then he said that looking into this vulnerability reminded him of a Bible prophecy in Ezekiel 7:14. This passage, it's mostly about the modern US and UK, and it says, "They've blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof. So it's a, you know, a very sobering picture that's painted by this passage. Mr. Fleury says it's about a time in the future when U.S. military technology will have been hijacked and compromised by enemies. And he writes, "It seems everybody is expecting our people to go into battle, but nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist?" Mm. So, you know, the news from this week about China's ongoing attacks against America's computer systems, it shows how dependent the U.S. remains on those kinds of systems and just how dangerous that dependence is. So I think that all shows just how quickly this Achilles heel could be punctured.
Nearly three decades old, that article, and America's dependence hasn't decreased at all. It's certainly, if anything, it's gotten much worse than it was at the time. And as in the case is so many times, Gerald Fleury has pointed to these dangers that end up being far greater than realized at the time that he first gave the warning. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Margaret Thatcher. You may have to fight a battle more than once to win it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.